It's my pleasure and honor to introduce Laura Hanos-Webb, PhD, clinical psychologist. Laura has been a former assistant professor at Santa Clara University, the former postdoctoral research fellow at the University of California in San Francisco, and the author of The Gift of ADHD, How to Transform Your Child's Problems into Strengths. Dr. Hanos-Webb is a worldwide ADD expert and offers ADD coaching. Dr. Hanos-Webb is a clinical psychologist and author, as I just said, The Gift of ADHD, The Gift of ADHD Activity Book, The Gift of Adult ADD, and the ADHD Workbook for Teens. And one that I've read and really got a lot out of, Listening to Depression, How Understanding Your Pain Can Heal Your Life. That's a good one. Her work has been featured in Newsweek, The Wall Street Journal, Prevention Magazine, The Chicago Tribune, and Publishers Weekly, as well as newspapers across the country and local and national radio and television. Dr. Hanos-Webb completed a 2-year postdoctoral research fellowship at the University of California in San Francisco and has been an assistant professor teaching graduate students. She's published more than 25 scholarly articles. And currently, she is, and most importantly, she is also the mother of 2 children, a 7 and a 9-year-old. Let's welcome Dr. Hanos-Webb.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me? Good. Okay. Well, I thought that I would start off my talk today with some of my own brain scans. I know that we've been looking at brain scans in a lot of the other talks during this conference, so this is one of mine. As you can guess, it's with PowerPoint or Photoshop. So it's not a real brain scan, but I think it kind of paints a picture of some of the points that I'm going to be talking about today, which is going to be the imaginative gifts of ADHD. As you mentioned, I've written several books that have some combination of the gift of ADHD in the title, and I was asked today to talk very specifically about imagination. And I'll also be talking about what is the relationship between imagination and creativity. And so we'll spend some time unpacking that. And one of the other, the subtitle was How Fantasy Creates Reality. And so that was meant to be a little bit provocative in the sense that the idea we have is that if there's a kid in a classroom and he's spaced out, we could call him Space Cadet, then there's fantasies going on in his head, but that is by and large a waste of time. And I really want to challenge that today, and I'll challenge it with stories, I'll challenge it with research, and I will also come back around the end and say, you know, we know that there are some kids where their fantasies are basically, and adults, I'm sure there's been some adults that have had escapist fantasies in their life, but I will also make the case that those aren't a waste of time either. That even the most obviously escapist fantasy of sitting on a tropical island, of talking in an intergalactic bar, that those have a function, a meaning, and a purpose, and are also not a waste of time. So we'll come back to that. So I'll move past my brain scan here. And this is a quote that most people have seen on Facebook. Most people have seen this somewhere. Einstein. Everybody is a genius, but if you judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree, it will live its whole life believing it's stupid. Now, this isn't just a cute thing on Facebook to share with other people, to me, because this is really, when I work with adults and kids also, how I feel like I spend most of my time. If we apply that, what happens if you take a fish and you invite it to climb a tree for 12 years of its life? What are the consequences of that? And so I just want to take a moment to tell you a little bit about my perspective on this, which is that I'm a clinical psychologist. And so I see people that come to me that will have the diagnosis of ADHD. And I have had the sense that there's this huge disjunct between what happens in the education system and the fact that we don't really follow up on what happens to those kids. And, you know, I could also be talking about dyslexia. I could also be talking about auditory processing disorder. I could be talking about depression or anxiety. Kids that have a brain difference. And I think of it almost, if you could imagine that you went bowling, and every time you threw the ball, there was a curtain, and you had no idea if you were getting a strike or a gutter ball or what was happening. So I think that some of what I'm going to say to you today is as if I'm taking that curtain away and I'm showing you what happens downstream to those fish. Because I'm going to tell you, I'm going to show you what I see every week. This is just another way of saying the same thing. We see a monkey, a penguin, an elephant, a fish, a wolf, and a seal. And says, okay, everybody, we're going to all take the same exam. Please climb that tree. Okay. So what do you find? Let's lift up the curtain, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about my observations. It's probably a little bit obnoxious that I put fish is equal to ADHD student and studying is equal to climbing tree. You probably all could have figured that out, but felt like I had to just make it clear. So what happens downstream? What I see are adults who are amazingly gifted, and I can tell you some stories about some of them. I have a client who, he writes like Dan Brown, and came so scarred from the education system, just even in Ken Robinson's video, if you were here for that, about what would it have been like to teach Shakespeare at age 7. In today's education system, he may have ended up getting incredibly bored and totally checked out. So this is what I see downstream. I see not only do they have the original brain difference, let's call it ADHD, but in addition, they have depression, anxiety, and addictions. And in specific to ADHD, and maybe it's some quality about my practice, but when I'm talking about addictions, one thing that is very, very common, and again, maybe a little bit obnoxiously, call it the trifecta, because it's really not about winning a bunch of horse races. It's actually about having three different serious interactions that the interaction of which is disabling in itself. What is that trifecta that I see? Pot, porn, and video games. And so, you know, here, being close to Oaksterdam, it may be that pot is a little bit more of a local common addiction, but it's also a common form of self-medication for most people with, well, with for people with ADHD. And why I say that it's a particularly bad combination, as you can imagine, a 25-year-old who spends most of his time on his iPhone watching porn or watching video games and stoned out of his mind. And so now imagine what it looks like when that 25-year-old goes to apply for a job. Usually disabled self-esteem and not a lot of real-world experience. And certainly not the kind of experience that they're capable of. So studying, again, pointing a picture that isn't that convenient that dying is in the word. And I think what I mean by that is that for these children who are bright and creative, and I'm going to spend some time talking about what I think the gifts of ADHD are, but for those children to be where they are evaluated and valued for their capacity to study leads to what I'm calling the downstream problem of depression, anxiety, and addictions. So as we start to look at this, one of the other points that I want to make, and this is the point I make in all of my books, is that ADHD and the symptoms of it are the side effects of a deep imagination. And in a moment, I'm actually going to map on all of the descriptions of the words incubation, which is one of the stages of creativity, and inspiration directly to the symptoms in the DSM of ADHD. And you'll see there's a substantial overlap. And it's interesting because I think in the real world, again, this is what I'm talking about with where you're bowling and there's a curtain and you don't know what's really going on, is in the real world, the ability to create something new is valued highly. And that's really what imagination does. Nobody thinks that the point of studying is to create something new. It's to get a good grade on a test. It's to learn the material. It's to achieve a level of mastery. So ADHD gives students a lot of fantasies. And so kind of the poster child of ADHD would be someone who's kind of staring off into space. Now, this is what I say to teachers all the time. Have you ever thought, and parents, about saying, what are you thinking about? What's going on in your head? And I find I usually get really interesting answers. And another part of that is that they are engaging material in a completely different way and often are not completely checked out. Going back to the Shakespeare example, you could imagine him in a math class, I don't know what kind of classes they had, and writing these incredible works of literature in his brain, and the teacher thinking, well, he just isn't paying attention. So anyways, and these are part of what's causing the distraction. So does it really make sense to say that a person isn't paying attention? And it's interesting because I've been saying this for many years, and at this conference, in a lot of the research and the real brain scans, but not like mine, the real brain scans that people were showing, they found out that when people were what used to be called a resting state, that was the part that was consuming the most glucose. The brain was the most active. And it really supports what I have always said. Is it really possible to not be paying attention? They're just not paying attention. And this is the key phrase to what they're supposed to be paying attention to. And that's the whole place between the education system and the downstream fish that's trying to climb a tree is what they're supposed to be paying attention to. Okay. So again, I will map very specifically the stages of creativity onto the symptoms of ADHD. So the stages of creativity are preparation, incubation, inspiration, verification, and creating products. So let's move forward. And I'm going to argue that ADHD are children who are very good at incubation and very good at inspiration. They're spacey and easily distracted by irrelevant thoughts. So this is, again, one of those places where one phrase tells us so much. So much about the disorder versus the gift. This is in the DSM, easily distracted by irrelevant thoughts. So what is an irrelevant thought? If Shakespeare is sitting in a class and he's not learning how to write his letters because he's so far behind that, is that an irrelevant thought? And so the entire basis of one of the main symptoms depends on what's irrelevant and what's relevant. And who makes that decision? Obviously the teacher. Obviously the curriculum standards. So again, and I have heard that one of the main points of this conference is to try to make kids' own passions be a relevant part of the curriculum. So that's important. Fail to give close attention to details. So I want to invite you to think, I'm assuming people went to most of the talks. I think it was Professor Yang's research where she talked about in order to make meaning out of information, to make meaning out of it, that's really, to most people and in the real world, would be very important, that you actually have an internal focus. You're not focused on the real world, and that you actually move away from executive functioning. Not giving close attention to details. Again, an internal focus. It could be the process of making meaning out of information. Didn't listen when spoken to directly. So what I'm also saying here is that this process of incubation, as it's described in theory and as it looks like in brain scans, is really consistent with all of the symptoms of ADHD. So imagine this idea of incubation. You've got ideas going on in your head. How can I do this? How can we solve these problems? What are we going to do about it? Avoided sustained mental effort. So that can look like in the real world, in the external world, they're not putting forth that effort. But inside, when it looks like nothing's going on, what Dr. Andreessen called, what she called the dark matter, that the brain is, it's very active, but it's in a state of rest. She said you could be lying in a bed, and that would be when your brain was most active. Forgetful in daily activities. So, again, this idea of being preoccupied, and again, forgetful, which means forgetting the relevant, the important things in life. So, again, you can imagine that that's a matter of, that people would have disagreements about what was relevant. And inspiration. So this is the third stage of creativity. And I'm going to argue that it maps right on to the impulsive symptoms of ADHD. So fidgets. So again, I have this picture in my brain of, from Dr. Andreessen's talk of the Archimedes. And he has his eureka moment, and I don't know if someone can correct me, but he runs through the street. Is he naked? Is he what? is he naked? Okay, he forgets things. He forgets things. He's impulsive because he's inspired. Okay, so if you think about Archimedes running through the streets saying, "Eureka," let's look at the rest of these symptoms. He can't sit still. Of course he can't. He's made a big discovery. Felt restless. Because things are happening. He's having some exciting ideas. He's thinking of different things. And then, as if driven by a motor, I love this because this is in the DSM, but it sounds like poetry, as if. It's a metaphor. We have a metaphor in the DSM, our medical journal, the Bible of the field. And it's true. It's true. And if a person is driven by a motor, it's kind of like if it really feels like that to the kid, we might want to rethink our punishment of it. Talks excessively. Blurts out answers. Well, why would you blurt out things unless you thought you had a great idea? And I work with this so much between parents and kids. And I have these tools, and the tools are I teach my kids to say, know when to back off. Or the parents say, know when to back off. And the kid says, I know when to back off. So they're learning how to back off. But why are they doing it in the first place? Because they think they've got great ideas. And as we go forward, I'm going to be making the case that I think it's in our best interest for our kids to think that their ideas are good. I do. I think that's a good thing. They can't wait their turn. And they're always interrupting others. That sounds like a person who's inspired. It sounds like someone who's on fire. And I often see it that way, even in my office. And the parents are very frustrated. But I think it may be something that needs to be managed. They need to learn some tools for dealing with their inspiration. But I think if we call it what it is and can look to the positive side of it, that it's in the best interest of that child. And the reason is because, again, let's take off the curtain where you're bowling and seeing what kind of results you're getting downstream. These kids are showing up depressed and anxious. And if every idea they have is a bad idea, and if every thought they have is an inappropriate thought, an irrelevant thought, would that make you anxious? Would that make you doubt yourself? And really, that's the fundamental basis of anxiety and depression. And we'll talk some more about that. So for the rest of the talk, I really want to just talk about three main points. And I'm just going to kind of circle around them. And the first one is that fantasy can create reality. And again, so in the classroom, and for parents, they're lost in space. What are they doing? They're always talking about this other stuff. I remember... the other day my daughter wanted to have a very lengthy conversation about, is there more blue in the world or is there more green in the world? This was really, really important to her. And we have conversations like this all the time. And so there's this ongoing fantasy life in kids, and what is the importance of it? But we'll talk about some more specific examples of in the real world. It's called self-efficacy if you believe that you can have an idea in your head and then translate that idea into the real world, we have a name for that. It's called self-efficacy. And without it, you're depressed and you're anxious. So that's something we're going to keep coming back to. The other idea is that ADHD kids are distracted and driven by this imagination, by these fantasies. So, and also that the way that we educate creative minds is that we value this process, that we help the kid identify what it is and show that there's some value to it. And then I want to kind of circle around this idea as we go along, which is studying leads to good grades. And that's a good thing. I think we all agree with that. The problem is, you know, I'm talking about kids with ADHD. I'm talking about kids who have a brain difference that doesn't actually lend itself very well to studying, that they learn in different ways. And then thinking, and I'm not talking like a cognitive scientist, I'm just kind of saying thinking, that process by where we try to solve a problem and we use the things that we already know and we apply them to the real world. Thinking leads to problem solution. Again, highly valued in the real world. And imagination leads to world changers, and I'll come back with some interesting examples. Everybody knows about Edison, everybody knows about Einstein, but I don't know if you know that Google was in part based on a dream. And so we'll come back to that. Monster.com, based on a dream. We'll come back to that. Some more modern examples. So this is a quote from Carl Jung. Without this playing with fantasy, no creative work has ever yet come to birth. The debt we owe to the play of imagination is incalculable. So again, just trying to open our minds about the value of this. And then in terms of this idea of does fantasy lead to reality and the difference between thinking, studying, and imagination. Does anyone know the work of Anne-Marie Roper or know of the Roper School? Nobody. Okay. Anne-Marie Roper lived in the Bay Area until she died last year at the age of 93. But she had, at the age of 18, escaped from Nazi Germany. And she came to the United States, and she had this idea. And it was her belief that what happened in Nazi Germany, the Holocaust, could not have happened if the German people could think for themselves. She thought that they had the schooling, the education was completely about obedience. And she really believed that she wanted to create a school that the number one outcome was children who could think for themselves. And I went to that school for only 1 year. And you see these bubbles here. Those were classrooms. And this is in the Detroit, Michigan area. I don't know if there's anyone here from there. Anyone from Detroit, Michigan? No. So these are there. And, you know, and I just have some memories of being in the class. And what happened was you created a contract with your teacher. And you said, this is what I'm going to do. And they would have to sign off on it, so you couldn't just goof around the whole time. And you would just kind of follow through, and you would do what you were supposed to do, but there was also modern dance. There was photography. There was lots of other types of activities so that the child was interested and engaged. So there's two points to this story. One is you can have a school where the point of it is for people to think for themselves, and you think that that's the best outcome. Personally, as a parent, I think that's the best outcome. I think the other best outcome is for kids to leave elementary school loving school. I think it's a big mistake when, parents pressure, and kids leave elementary school. It's like they have a whole marathon ahead of them. So the love of school and thinking for themselves, I think, can be outcomes that we think are important. And I know the rest of the world, this is a private school, the rest of the world, that's not going to work. But it could be a goal. It could be a fantasy that we have in our head. That wouldn't that be wonderful if that was what we valued in our kids? And so again, here's Einstein. So he's making the case not only, do fantasies lead to reality, but in his case, he discovered the theory of relativity through imagining riding on a wave of light or beam of light.
So I just want to come back a little bit to this idea of definition. What is imagination? Owen Barfield says the individual mind exercising its sovereignty.
So what does that mean? It's the difference between passively taking in the world and imagination says the world could be different. It's you're being sovereign over what's already out there. And so here the idea is it's something superior to studying, for example. And maybe it is. So there is this idea. I also think of it as film-like visual images. And then, you know, again, in my practice, there seems to be an association between ADHD and dyslexia and people that kind of think in pictures. And so this kind of goes hand in hand with an active fantasy life and imagination.
Jerome Singer at Yale says, daydreaming is a critical way in which humans move beyond their immediate environment, and I love this, vicarious virtual realities. What if we thought of imagination as vicarious virtual realities that allow them to try out alternative personalities and interests?
Again, I'm going to transition a little bit back to my role as a psychologist, psychotherapist, because as a psychotherapist, it's really obvious that, and the quote here says, live out your imagination, not your history, that what makes people change is to have an imagination of something that's different from what it already is. And for so many people, that's hard to do. And I wonder if it's because we don't value it in school, and so people don't have an experience of saying, oh, I have an imagination, now I turn it into reality. I have another imagination, now I'll turn it into another reality. And I remember when I was in graduate school in Oxford, Ohio, which was Miami University, which is kind of like a campus, but mostly just a cow field. And I had applied for a job at University of California, San Francisco, for a postdoc. And I remember coming to the interview, and I remember after I got accepted, there was a really big barrier to me saying yes. And it was, well, San Francisco is a global tourist destination. I'm coming from a cow field. People don't really live like that, do they? And it almost seemed too good to be true. I didn't have an imagination that you could live in a global tourist destination. I grew up in the Detroit area. I went to school in the Ohio cow field area. And the idea that I would live in San Francisco just was off my radar. But I had to create a fantasy about what that would look like. And I did. So again, in therapy, this idea that fantasies is the basis of change is pretty straightforward. And then if we're kind of a specialist, let's say, in hypnosis or guided imagery, the whole idea is you create a new fantasy and then reality follows. So it could be as simple as, I'm not a smoker. It could be as simple as, I'm running a marathon. And you kind of go through the guided imagery and you believe those fantasies and images, and then people's realities really do change. So again, ADHD and imagination. I wrote about it in my book, The Gift of ADHD. And sometimes when I've talked at schools, teachers have said, well, it's wonderful that ADHD may be associated with ADHD, that imagination is associated with ADHD, but imagination is a problem in the classroom. And so that doesn't really help me out. And it's funny because when I was teaching as a graduate student, I taught undergraduate classes, and at Santa Clara University, I taught graduate students. And I noticed something really interesting in my office hours. And it comes back to this idea of studying versus thinking versus imagining. The straight A students were really, really good and interested in studying. So when they would come to my office hours, what a time felt like was, what's on the text on Thursday? Page 22 says X, and page 34 says Y. What's the right answer? And so it wasn't really about engaging the material. It wasn't. It was about studying and getting the good grades. the ADHD students, and this is really the moment where this idea came to me, were so much more interesting to talk to. The ADHD students were the ones who changed my thinking, that I felt like I was learning from them. And because they were challenging ideas, they were exploring the ideas, they were excited by the ideas, they were coming up with their own ideas. And it was a completely different experience. And if you're wondering, how did I get the ADHD students to come to office hours? I have an answer for that. I made it a course requirement to come to office hours. So maybe I saw a phenomenon that other people have never seen, what an ADHD person looks like at office hours, because they usually skip out on that kind of thing. So let's just go through what is ADHD in the DSM. I mapped on some of the symptoms to some of what I think are incubation, and I also think of as inspiration. But let's kind of just go through the whole diagnostic process. Just a couple minutes. I don't know, did anybody see on Super Bowl Saturday or Sunday? That's how good I am at sports. Super Bowl Sunday. Did anyone go to Starbucks and look down at the New York Times and see what was there? It was a whole front page, and it went on to take up four full pages of the New York Times. And what was it? It was called Drowned in a Stream of Prescriptions. And it was a really tragic story. And I don't like to be one of those fear-monger people, and I'm not going to go there about ADHD and fear-mongering. But there was something in it, in the story, the tragic ending of a child who died because of getting multiple prescriptions from multiple doctors of Adderall. That's not common at all. It's not common. So I don't want to go there and fear-monger. But there's something in that story, four full pages of the New York Times, that was very, very, very common, was how quickly he got a diagnosis of ADHD from so many doctors and was given prescriptions. How quickly he got these diagnoses. I mean, I think a psychiatrist should do better than a guy on a bar stool saying, you know what, you're having problems with attention? Have you heard of this ADHD thing? Because that is what the New York Times documented, that a person could walk into a doctor and say, I'm having problems paying attention, and get a diagnosis. So really, I just want to lay out just some basic gold standard elements of a diagnosis. The main three clusters we all know about: inattention, difficulty paying attention, difficulty following through, and then again, the big one, paying attention to things that are irrelevant. Totally irrelevant. To who? That's a different question. Impulsivity, which is not being able to control your urges or speaking out, blurting things out. Hyperactivity, excess physical or mental restlessness. Okay. So, but what I want to go back, because what I want to just say in just a couple minutes, this is my public service announcement, is that the guy on the bar stool could tell you that, but that is not how we make a diagnosis. We have to rule out alternative explanations. So to me, the worst example of this is parents take their 14-year-old son to the developmental psychiatrist, the developmental pediatrician, and says, he's not interested in school anymore. He cannot focus. Gets a diagnosis of ADHD, 45 minutes later has a prescription. Now, does anyone in the room know about a well-documented developmental phenomenon that happens around the age of 14? Has anyone heard of this? Then puberty? Puberty, anyone? He's not interested in school because he's interested in 14-year-old girls, right? We all know that. Okay. So, but if your job is to give people a diagnosis, you may just forget about that. And people don't get ADHD at age 14. It has to have been there before. So we have to rule out alternative explanations. And puberty is an obvious one, and it's kind of a funny one. But there are hundreds of other reasons people have difficulty paying attention. Big one, sleep. learning disorders, very specific learning disorders. Stress in the family. Another one, family divorces. Child went from two parents in a home to two different homes, totally two different rules. Could you as an adult live like that and have an easy time paying attention? So again, ruling out alternative explanations and other diagnoses. The other thing is we have to establish a clinically significant impairment in functioning. There's so many personality traits. There's so many things like tempo, different styles, learning styles that could look like ADHD or could be ADHD or be on a continuum of ADHD, or even as in the earlier talk, they could have the gene for ADHD, but that doesn't mean you have ADHD. And so you have to establish a clinically significant impairment in functioning. So, okay, so that's my public service announcement. And we'll go back to the gifts of ADHD. So creativity. I've talked about how it even seems to map onto two stages of the five stages of creativity, incubation and inspiration. And I'm going to do kind of a cliff notes of some of the other people's presentations to show that the brain scans of what a creative brain looks like are very similar to even the brain scans of ADHD and certainly the traits of ADHD. Exuberant. So high energy, overexcitability, and sometimes it can be just a profound engagement. Emotionally sensitive. I have a client who says, you know, when I respond to social situations, I feel like it's like if you threw a pebble in the water, I am like the 10th wave out. I take it all the way to the 10th wave, and I can't relate to other people because they only take it to the second wave. And that's an example of emotional sensitivity. Interpersonal intuition. So this is kids who can read you like a book. And they're good at knowing what's going on in other people. And it can, I think of Emerson's quote, which is, I can't hear what you're saying because who you are is speaking so loudly. And I think some of the ADHD kids have this as a gift. And then what I call ecological consciousness or nature smart, which when I first wrote my book really sounded very Northern California-like. And of course, since then, it has expanded with, you know, Lou's nature deficit disorder, and it's much, much more widely accepted. I don't know if this is the first time you've heard these kind of ideas, this way of looking at ADHD, but one thing I would suggest, if it's Monday or maybe Tuesday because of President's Day, you know, when you're in the classroom, what would it be like to just experiment with that and to just notice if you see some of these gifts and to reflect it back to those children? I guess there's another thing that I'm trying to say here, which is, if I had a broken leg and I had some positive thoughts about that broken leg, I might feel better, but it's actually not going to change the broken leg. But all of the symptoms of ADHD are specific behaviors. And the whole premise of psychotherapy, the whole premise of most of the field of psychology is that our thoughts affect our behavior. And so if you can change a person's thoughts, you can change their behavior. And this is really, again, consistent with what the previous speaker was saying, that if you look at some of these kids that even get a diagnosis, 2 years later, they don't even meet their criteria. What I'm saying is that this idea of the gift of ADHD, you may maybe not agree with it, but you could think of it as an intervention. And it is possible that by changing the thoughts, you actually change the behavior. Now, I wouldn't stand up here and say, if I gave you some positive attitudes about your broken leg, that you'd wake up tomorrow and it wouldn't be broken. I wouldn't say that. But I would say that it really is the basis of my whole field, but also something I have reliably observed my entire career, that people's behavior changes when they feel differently about themselves. 5 minutes. Okay. So Is it 5 minutes before that? Okay. Ooh, 5 minutes until... Oh, questions. Okay. So I'm going to go through some of this a little bit more quickly. But again, and I just want to say, you know, and there is research to support this. More recently, there was, well, in 2006, they just directly asked the question, let's measure adults with ADHD and let's measure adults without ADHD and let's give them measures of creativity. Lots of the types of measures you've already heard about, divergent thinking measures. And they found, absolutely, ADHD adults are more creative. So there's directly looking at the question, there is research. And this is kind of the cliff notes of everything I heard at the conference this week. And it's looking at the brain scan. So when you look at this, ADHD is considered a deficit of executive functioning and a deficit in the frontal lobes. And you know, even brain scans, more thin cortical mass in the frontal lobes. And the theme that I heard over and over again, the solution is when you shut down those inhibitions. That creativity is when you move away from the executive functioning. And these are, again, they're coming from brain scans. This isn't just theory or poetry that people are suggesting. And then again, Dr. Andreasen, she even talks about the disorganization that happens as a part of creativity in the brain with the associative cortexes. And she calls it the brain's dark energy. And here what we see, what she found, again, I said this before, is that there's more activity in the brain during what appears to be rest. And so, again, you have this picture of this spaced-out ADHD kid, and it's giving us these hints that there's much more going on. So, again, rest, relaxation, internal focus, all of these evocative of ADHD. So the theme that I heard was that creativity is a deficit of attention to the real external world. It's an internal focus. Bingo, that's ADHD. So we'll go through these quickly. We'll get to some pictures. Here, Monster.com, Jeff Taylor talked about that he had this vision. We'll start with Larry Page. At the University of Michigan in 2009, he talked about having a dream of downloading the whole web. And he said, when a great dream shows up, grab it and have a healthy disregard for the impossible. So this isn't just a vain fiction that I'm saying that fantasy creates reality. And we don't have to go back to Edison and Einstein. It's still happening today. It's still happening. The world changers are people who have imagination. Again, Jeff Taylor, I'm a dreamer. I dream different capacities. I work in a different plane, and I can't explain it. And he says, I had a dream of a happy monster logo and a concept big, not scary. So everyone knows what Monster.com is. It's a job search engine. Is that right? Okay. So this is the idea of how do we go, even in the case where it's really clear that the fantasies are escapist. This is the clinical observation that it is actually a picture of what the child needs or the adult needs. So I need to go to a tropical island. What is that? I need a break. I need rest. I need reduced stimulation. That's called incubation. That's exactly what they talked about with incubation. You need to rest. You need to get away from everything. And it can also mean, you know, I'm struck by, in I think it's Finland, the school day goes 45 minutes of work, 15 minutes of outside play. 45 minutes of work, 15 minutes of outside play. Most people understand that we can't focus and concentrate unstopped, that you need breaks. So those fantasies are about saying, I need a break, which is actually, I think, good science. So here, studying versus imagination. And I think it's time to get real for a child with ADHD or brain deference. Studying is just not productive. One of the other talks that I heard said that the researchers went in and looked at kids studying for 15 minutes. They paid attention for about 3 minutes at a time. And they were kids who knew that the researchers were watching them. Imagine what they would be doing on their own. So imagine, there we go. So for Men in Black. Now who, as an adult, doesn't have this feeling? This is the neuralizer, and it gives you a bright flash, and it erases your memory. I just have so many memories of in college studying material, and I have no idea. I don't have access to any of that material anymore, all those all-nighters. So again, So I guess I'll end with this, and then I'll open it up for questions. And I remember when I finally overcame that idea that I can't really go live in San Francisco, because growing up in the Detroit area and then a school in a cow field, I thought that just isn't real. That isn't a real world thing. And it just seemed too far off my radar. But I remember when I came here, someone said to me, San Francisco is the center of the universe because it's the place where new ideas meet the least resistance. And I think it's probably true. But again, to give you, to plant a fantasy in your mind, what would it be like in a classroom if a classroom was a place where new ideas met with very little resistance? What would that look like? Can you imagine that? Okay, so I will end there and open it up for questions. And is my mic on or is that mic not on? Oh, I'll repeat the question. She said that she's thankful that it feels really true to her experience, and she was wondering about diet. So I think this is an important thing in ruling out alternative explanations. There has been research, and the research suggests that diet doesn't create ADHD. But I think that we all know that on the extremes, if a kid is either not having breakfast or they're just having sugar all day, or I read in Honey Boo Boo, she drinks Mountain Dew with Red Bull mixed together. I mean, if you see diet extremes like that, you're going to have something that looks a lot like ADHD. And then the other thing is, there are some basics of diet in terms of that seem straightforward. You know, and not many people are aware of this, but even like the stimulants that are used to treat ADHD need protein in order for them to work. And so you have these kids that aren't eating protein, and it really impairs the capacity for their medications to work. And then I think some other things are that, again, like the solid basics. And if you don't have that, it could look a lot like ADHD. I think another thing I would say about diet is there can be this idea about gluten sensitivity. And, one of my kids had some ear infections, and they recommended I do the gluten-free diet. And it took, like, a full-time job for me to try to figure that out. And so what I would suggest is, I mean, if there's a test for that, at least look into that, but get a test. And that there's some more straightforward things that can be done to, I think, manage the ADHD symptoms, which are you even getting the basics? Is there protein? Are they drinking water? Are they getting their liquids? Are they getting fresh fruits and vegetables? And it is one of the things that I ask people to look at in the process leading up to a diagnosis. So one of the things that I recommend, because it has become so overdiagnosed, is that families and adults, if I could tell you what I'm seeing with adult ADHD misdiagnoses, even to the level of, elderly people in the earlier stages of cognitive slippage getting diagnosed with ADHD for the first time in their life, women going through menopause and all of a sudden they can't pay attention, people who live lives where you can't be working three jobs and really, their lives don't work and because they're doing too much and it looks like ADHD, but it's not. So what I'm recommending is that families, adults, get 12 sessions of either parent coaching or therapy of some sort, where you're going to separate out the signal from the noise. And what I mean by that is, are you getting enough sleep? That's the first thing to look at. Again, diet is something that people should look at. And, stress. Of course, major stresses can create them. And then, if you go through those 12 sessions, what are the side effects of that? You're going to have increased social and emotional intelligence, which will last you for the rest of your life. So those are some pretty positive side effects. And especially with kids, you could prevent a lifelong diagnosis. And So I do think that's one thing you want to look at before you even go get an evaluation. So, yeah. Are there other questions? No. I'll put my email back, and you can email me. Just because they asked us to submit The stuff that's on the disc is not my slides. It's something else. But here's my email. So if you have any stories you want to share, comments or questions, feel free to email me. And if you like any of these, a lot of the pictures that I have are on my Facebook page for my book, The Gift of ADHD. So you can get a lot of the pictures there. My brain scan, as I talked about, are available. And all of my books are downstairs in the bookstore. So, do you have a question? Well, this is a good thing. I don't just say throw it all away. Usually what I recommend is for parents to increase their motivation. So it could look like this. All he wants to do is play video games. Why don't you ask him to go and do some research about the 6 gaming programs in the United States and have him look at what are the criteria to get into those gaming programs. And I think one of them, Santa Cruz, and I can't remember where they are, but there's majors in gaming. And so using something like this to have the child say, oh, I could go into gaming, I could make that my living, and well, look, even to get into that, I have to have good grades. So they began to start thinking of it within themselves. The other thing I want to say is if you increase motivation and you increase confidence, they're going to do better. And again, it's without looking within the child that we see these behaviors. When I ask a child, I say, okay, you're sitting there, you got your books up, and you know it's time to study. What's going through your head? And what's going through their head is, I can't do this. I can't do this. And so do you see how the history of punishment and rejection and feeling like they're a fish that can't climb a tree, it creates this vicious cycle. And so what I'm suggesting to you, that even turning the bus around and helping these kids to gain some confidence and letting them know that their real interests are a great way to build some skills and become a great motivation for studying. Because I don't think, the other thing I don't think we realize is a lot of kids believe that the real world is going to be just like school. And so they're not even motivated. But if you can explain to them that there are jobs out there that don't involve studying, but you maybe have to get good grades to get to those jobs, they will increase their motivation. I had one kid, a teenager, and I said, what is a perfect job? I want to move around a lot and I want to talk to people. Okay. What are some specific interests? Sports. Okay, what would it be like to be a physical therapist? I would love to do that. Okay, what do you need to do to be a physical therapist? All of a sudden, he has a fantasy in his brain that there's a whole world out there where I'm not going to get in trouble for talking to other people. I'm not going to get in trouble for wanting to move around. And then he has motivation to get through school. Done. Okay, done. Thank you.